This is Mort Fertel, and welcome back to the audio CD program called That's What I Was Going to Ask. Answers to the most common and crucial questions about fixing your marriage. This is CD 5.
Mort?
Yes?
It's Teresa.
Hello, Teresa.
How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Did you think about my question for you the other day in regards to, you know, you can't touch members of the opposite sex? As a nurse, how I wrote to you and said, I wouldn't dream of not touching someone
right. Who
was just diagnosed with cancer or just had a painful procedure
right. Or,
I mean, I could give you a whole host of examples.
Right, right. You did get my email back from that, right?
Yeah, you said you were pondering the thought.
Yeah, just to bring everybody up to speed, Teresa sent me a very thoughtful, I don't mean thoughtful like she was thinking of me, I mean it was a well thought out question that frankly gave me pause for thought. And essentially, Teresa's question was, you know, she's a nurse, and I guess she has dealt or does deal with people that are in life-threatening situations. Her job is not only to provide medical care, but, you know, I guess to some extent, you could say that a nurse and a doctor's job is not only to provide medical care, but also to provide comfort, emotional comfort to a patient. And sometimes I guess she or, you know, a doctor has got to break news to a patient that they have cancer, that they have 6 months to live, or that they have to have a serious surgery or whatever the circumstances are. And she said, frankly, to me, she said, Mort, I wouldn't dream, not pulling any punches, she's pretty definitive, I wouldn't dream of not placing my hand on the shoulder of a patient that I have to break this news to if it's going to comfort them more. And, you know, what are your thoughts on this?
When I do that, you know, we've had patients come in whose spouses have died, you know, and I
right. Dream
of not right. Even hugging them
right. Or,
you know, sometimes they're elderly.
Right.
But, you know, it's not an intimate act.
Right.
It's a compassionate act.
Right.
I mean, there is a difference.
There definitely
is. Maybe not.
No, there definitely is a difference. And, I mean, I have a few different thoughts. I'm going to tell you in advance, they're conflicting thoughts. Because I think it's such a good question that I'm a little bit conflicted about it. But one thought is that you're right, that there is a difference between an intimate act and a compassionate act. And Teresa's describing a compassionate act, and really, what's the problem? What's the harm? I'm the same person, but I'll play the other side. I could share with you many stories about, you know, men that have touched in a compassionate way, or women that have touched in compassionate way men, and that compassion is a very intimate experience. It strikes somebody in a certain way. You as a nurse, you know, making physical contact with a man, it's not feeling at all intimate to you, but it doesn't mean that it's not feeling intimate to them. There's a lot of people that really crave, I mean deeply crave, that kind of attention, that kind of affection.
Oh, sure.
And there's people that are not getting it, even in those life crisis situations, from the people that they should be getting it from. And so there you are, as Wayne described so vividly last week, there you are just stepping into that place. Now you're doing it with the greatest of intentions. But that may not be the way they receive it. I mean, after all, Wayne was not in a life-threatening situation when he described that scenario, but it's an interesting parallel.
But it wasn't the woman who was stepping in being so compassionate. She had a little bit more...
Maybe not.
...thoughts.
Maybe not.
Right.
Maybe at first she didn't.
Right.
That's my point. Maybe at first she was really just reaching out to somebody whose son had just died. And there she was. Here's another consideration. In that situation, you could be usurping the very role that their spouse should be playing. Because that's a very important role, to be there for somebody in those kinds of situations, to be the compassionate touch. If the spouse is available, I think that's a very important role that the spouse should be playing, to provide that compassion, to provide that gentle touch. And I agree with you. There's nothing like physical contact in certain instances. But if they get it from you, they may not get it or may not need it. Or it may be a different experience when they do get it from their spouse. Now, if their spouse is deceased, yeah, I hear the question. Some
very thought-provoking both ways, both sides, yeah.
Yeah, I can see it both sides. A friend of mine once shared with me something very profound. He once said that sometimes a question is better than the answer. Mm. And sometimes he said he has had experiences in his life where he sits with a question for years. He's got an answer. If you ask him the question, he'll give you an answer. But he'll also acknowledge that the question is better than the answer. And he'll sit with that for years. So I don't know. I think it's a great question. I see different sides to it. And it could be one of those situations where the question is better than the answer.
When you're a nurse, there's other touching. I mean, you know, I've certainly touched many body parts of men for a clinical reason.
That's a different story.
And that's what I kind of was talking about Monday, but then I started thinking about it, and I thought, no,
right.
Not really what I was trying to get across.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Hi, this is Lori again.
Hello, Lori again.
And I just have another question on emotional infidelity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're supposed to keep business talk at work. I mean, isn't there, like, some people I can engage in personal talk with? You know, like, I have friends there, and I'm honestly, what it feels like? It feels like quitting smoking. I just, by the time I get out of there, there's just so much tension. I feel like my head's going to pop.
Right.
Because I'm used to being...
Right, but as you've been, let me ask you, you've been doing that this week. What is the effect of that then on your home experience when you get home with Don?
Well, I can't wait to get home because it's so hard for me not to talk about anything that comes to mind.
Uh-huh. You can't wait to get home, and then what when you get home?
Talk because...
Uh-huh. And is that working? You guys talking more?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's working just like I described it would work. And you need that in your marriage. Mm-hmm. Somebody emailed me the following question. How do we rekindle that romantic love that seems to be the driving force in keeping him there? Now, that's the end of the email, but let me explain, since I know who the email is from. Him there refers to another woman. So the question is, how do I... how do we rekindle that romantic love that seems to be the driving force that keeps him involved with this other woman? Okay, so that's an excellent question. And I'm sure it's something that, I know it's something that a few of you at least are struggling with. This is actually something that, you know, I spend quite a bit of time working on with people privately in coaching sessions, and it's going a real elaborate and complete explanation, and particularly one tailored to your situation would require more than the few minutes I'm going to give it here, but at least this will give you some direction. So first of all, it's important to understand when we speak about romance, when we speak about the physically intimate part of our life, sex, that there really are two sides to that coin. In other words, building a romantic life is kind of like climbing a ladder, in the sense that one hand and one leg on the same side of the body goes up one rung, and then the other leg and the other hand goes up at the same time to get you to the next rung, and you keep alternating sides in order to climb that ladder. So what are the two sides of our sex life? Our physically intimate life and our emotionally intimate life are two sides of the same process. They go hand in hand, and one really can't elevate without the other. In other words, you can work all day and night on your physically intimate life, on your romantic life, and you try all the different sex positions and sex toys that you can come up with. But the fulfillment and the satisfaction you and your spouse get from that sex life will be stopped out, so to speak, will be limited by your emotional connection. And so, too, your emotional connection, you can spend all day and night creating an emotionally intimate, successful relationship. But to some extent, that emotional connection will be stopped out, will be limited by your ability to connect physically. Because that's what really is unique and special about a marriage, unlike any other relationship, is that it includes both the physical and the emotional. But they feed upon each other. They help elevate each other, or they help degenerate each other. And so it's just important, even when you begin to ask the question, that you realize that I can't answer the question just in the context of two bodies that are going to connect. It's really about a whole relationship. It's about a whole marriage. And the emotional component to your relationship is bound up and intertwined with the physical component of your relationship as well. Furthermore, it always amazes me, and it's almost always true, that no matter how many years two people have been together, they just don't know each other. Physically, they don't know each other. They don't know what each other's fantasies are. They don't know what each other's desires are. They don't know what feels good and what doesn't feel good, what they want, what they don't want, how they want to do it, how often they want to do it. For some reason, this is just a topic that people just don't discuss freely. And I understand that. I mean, I feel to some extent the same inhibition. But you've got to move through it. You know, you've got to have the discipline to recognize that if you want your romantic life to succeed, you've, just like succeeding in anything else, as we've discussed, you've got to be willing to do what you don't want to do because you know you need to do it. And you've got to talk. You simply have to talk. You've got to communicate. And you've got to find a way to facilitate that communication. Now, there are all different ways you can do that. I mean, I'm working with a few couples right now that, you know, their way to do that is through private marriage coaching sessions with me. And I'm literally facilitating and walking them through step by step, asking the questions. I am literally in the middle of very intimate, graphic, detailed discussions about their sex life. And that's okay. It's healthy. Many couples need that kind of assistance. It's normal. It's natural. And if you are so inclined, you might want to seek that help in order to move forward in your romantic life. Now, there are other options also. You could try to initiate conversation with your spouse about these things and see if he or she is open to it. If not, maybe you could agree to go through a book or a workbook about this topic. And that's one way to facilitate and initiate discussions on the topic. I'm not going to go on and on with more and more of these types of ideas, but the bottom line on this is communication. I mean, there literally is information, data, if I could be clinical about it, that needs to be communicated between a man and a woman. And it's always amazing how many years couples could be together and they simply have never had that dialogue. And so it's important to do it. Then, after you do it, after you dialogue about it, it's important to try, to whatever extent you're comfortable, to respond to what you learned. Kind of like the intimacy interview. I don't think that anybody should ever do anything they're not comfortable doing sexually. In other words, you have to be careful how far you push yourself. It's good if you want to fulfill your husband or wife's fantasies and needs and desires and interests. And you should be willing to push yourself a little bit. In other words, be willing to experiment with things you might not otherwise be willing or interested in doing. But, you know, if you're uncomfortable, then of course you should draw the line. You shouldn't do anything that will make you uncomfortable that you really don't want to do. But to A, find out what it is that really turns on your husband or wife, interests your husband or wife, and then to explore that with them. It's a very intimate thing. You know what's intimate about it? And it's an interesting insight into what intimacy is. What's interesting about it is it's unknown. It's new. It's mysterious. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know how you're going to feel. You don't know how your spouse is going to feel. And that makes you and your spouse vulnerable. And that's an intimate experience. That mystery, stepping into that unknown place with each other, especially naked. I mean that literally and metaphorically. In other words, when you go sexually to an unknown place with a person, you've really got to be comfortable with them. It creates comfort in a sense. It creates intimacy once you've been there with that person. And once you've broken through and you've been to that mysterious place with them, then you'll be more willing to continue to experiment. And that leads me to another part of this discussion, which I think is relevant too, which is that I think that most of us need to work on our inhibitions and need to work on being more uninhibited. I think the most exciting and romantic and fulfilling thing about romance and sex is to experience the inhibition and the pleasure of your spouse. In other words, people often, I think, get it backwards. They think that what's really most fulfilling and satisfying about sex is having an orgasm. I don't think so. I actually think it's experiencing your spouse's orgasm. That's exciting. That is romantic. That's the kind of thing that really makes your eyes spin. And so what's our work? Well, really two things. One is learning what we need to learn in order to bring our spouse to that place. How can we help them not only mechanically to achieve orgasm, but more than that, how can we help them really be uninhibited with us? What is it about their body or their sex life that is blocking them up, that is making them feel at all inhibited? And how can we help them feel more comfortable? Maybe it's something as mechanical as the level of the lighting. Or maybe it's something much more personal that needs to be fleshed out and discussed. That's in terms of how we can help our spouse. But also in terms of our work, what do we need to do in order to be more uninhibited in our romantic life? Because I can almost promise you that the most fulfilling and exciting thing for your spouse is your inhibition. And so what do you need to do to get there? What do you need to do to really relax and to be uninhibited? It's that type of inhibition, that type of just being there completely naked with each other. And again, I mean that metaphorically as well as literally, because it is that uninhibited nakedness that is a very special form of intimacy. That creates romance. It creates romance for the next time. Because really, what's the difference between romance and sex? The difference is romance is the anticipation, and sex is the activity itself. And so one of the things that creates romance is the previous sexual encounter, because it is part of the anticipation. It's because it's in our mind. It's part of the anticipation of the next sexual encounter. It takes some courage, to be honest, you know? It really does. It takes some courage to do the work to try to get comfortable with your own body enough to go to that uninhibited place where you're really just in your spouse's hands. That is really the amazing thing about having an uninhibited orgasm with your spouse. You've essentially completely given control to them. They control you at that point. But there's a very beautiful, vulnerable, intimate thing about being controlled in that sense. And this is why people that tend to be controlling type people have a very hard time giving up that control and going to that place. Anyway, I think I'm going to stop there on the topic. There's much more to be said about the matter, and so much about the matter also relates to your unique situation and is work that you would have to work through either, again, with a third party or using a book. But there's only so much that can be said about the topic in a general sense, and then you've really got to get down to what your particular body issues are, what your particular fantasies are, what your particular lack of communication with your spouse about your needs, interests, and desires have been, and all that stuff. I encourage you to take these general ideas that I've given you and to translate them into the details of your situation and see what you can do to improve your romantic life, because almost all of us have work to do in that area, and our marriage could dramatically benefit from us doing that work. Right. Well, go to the tape, as that sportscaster says. I got an email question here from somebody, and it's a short one. I don't know if the answer will be short, but the question is short. The question is, what if a spouse forgets his or her role in the relationship recovery process? Would it be appropriate for the other spouse to remind them? So I'll start answering this question with a brief story. A number of weeks ago, it was in the middle of the winter here in Baltimore. Things were freezing. The illnesses and the flus and viruses were going around. My whole family got sick. All four kids, including my wife, somehow I was the only one to survive this virus that went around our house. And when you have four little kids that are sick and they're throwing up all over the place and they're up at night and it's coming out of both ends, I mean, it's a mess. And it's difficult and it creates a lot of work and it's a real burden on the parents. It's particularly difficult when during this time the primary caretaker of all these kids is also sick, that being my wife. And she was. She was really not well. And I certainly helped a lot more than I normally do. But the truth is that Mr. Marriage Fitness didn't come through as much as he probably should have and as much as he could have. It was also a difficult and challenging week for me at work. I had a full schedule in terms of I was in the middle of a boot camp. I had a number of sessions. I was a full day intensive house call in Denver with a couple for one of those days. It was just, and then when I come back from those trips, it's very intense because I have all the emails and the mess. It was a complicated time. But if my head and my heart were really in the right place, I would have put love first more often and really helped out much more because my wife needed the help and it was a difficult time. I didn't completely fail. I certainly was there a lot more than I normally would have been. But in retrospect, I realized that it was not the best week for me as a husband. Anyway, my family and I, we always have dinner together. We have dinner together most nights, but Friday night we have a big special dinner together every week, just my wife and I and the kids. And my wife usually kind of goes all out and makes a real nice meal, and we make it a special time. So Friday, I guess it was afternoon, I actually thinking that maybe I would, because she wasn't feeling well, maybe I would go and I would get some takeout food, because it takes a lot of time and energy to make these meals, and she wasn't feeling well, and I thought I would give her a break. So I didn't want to do that if she had already made a big meal, so I kind of just poked a little question in there, what's the story with dinner? I wanted to see if it would be a nice gesture for me to go get this takeout food and make it a little easier on her on Friday night. Anyway, as I poked around, she responded after having this horrific week and after me, to some extent, I think, failing her as a husband and having four sick kids and her herself being sick. Friday afternoon, when I said, what's the story with dinner? She said, oh, I actually made your favorite meal. And she went on to describe every single dish, from the main course to the side dishes to the dessert, was my favorite meal. If I had to plan my menu for my birthday meal or something like that, this would be it. And she made it for me during this week when things were so complicated, so difficult, and she was feeling not very well. And I remember thinking at that moment, that was really the moment when it hit me that I blew it. all week long, I can't honestly say that I was aware that I wasn't stepping up to the plate as much as I should have. It was at that moment that I realized, uh-oh, I blew it. It's like when she did so much for me, when she extended such a nice gesture, that's what really caused me to really look at myself, look at the week, and to realize the work that I had done. And that following week, I was like super Mr. Marriage Fitness. I mean, it really inspired me. It really kind of got me on my horse. So let me just read the question to you again. What if a spouse forgets his or her role in the relationship recovery process? Would it be appropriate for the other spouse to remind them? The answer is yes. But the question is how? How do you remind them? I think you're probably asking in this email, could I have a discussion with them? Could I mention something? Could I say something? Now, of course, the answer to that question is yes also. If your relationship is strong enough, if they won't feel like they're being pressured, if you have the ability to finesse the conversation so that you can be gentle and sensitive to their feelings, then you could do that too. I'm not saying that you can't. You could. But there is no greater message than your life. And who you are, and what you do. And before you go and say something and have like a serious, dramatic, sit-down conversation, which, again, you can do, and your relationship and you yourself might be able to handle it. But before you do that, I would try to communicate it in a more positive way. Rather than being critical, I would actually go and do something that's really outstanding that might get your spouse to evaluate what they're doing on their part and come to realize themselves that they're not stepping up as much as they should, that they're a little bit off track. You know, I was mentioning to somebody else today the life of Gandhi. Gandhi is a perfect model of how the way we live can impact other people. I mean, this is a man who never held a political position in his life. He never held a knife in his hand or a gun in his pocket. And yet he changed the lives of millions of people and brought the most powerful nation in the world to its knees. How did he do it? It was through his example. It was through his life. It was through the behaviors and actions of his daily routine. And that transformed people. It lit them up. It inspired them. Because it's one thing to be able to articulate ideas, and it's another thing to really be able to live it. I was just commenting with somebody else the other day that for me, one important thing for me to be able to do in my life in order to be good at my work is for me to really take the time and the energy to renew myself in whatever way that works for me. Which occasionally, as I mentioned last night, is watching inspiring and dramatic movies. For me, it's exercising every morning on a regular basis. It's reading classical and great literature in the evening. You know, I think I mentioned to you that I was reading some Hegel, who's one of the great philosophers. You know, I need to do these things to renew myself, because I believe that all of you can hear something about my life in my voice that goes beyond the words that I say. I really believe that because I know that I feel it in other people. In other words, I can't give you any more than I am. And so the most important thing that I could be doing for my work is to develop myself and my marriage and my relationship with my wife. And the more I make of that, the more I'm able to give you. Because I believe that you can feel in me what kind of husband I am, what kind of person I am, what my character is, what my level of integrity is. And ultimately, beyond all the word that I articulate and the stories I tell and the ideas that I share, there is a unspoken energy that emanates from me that I believe you can pick up, and I think you have more to, I hope you have more to learn from that and more to be inspired from that than anything else. And so to answer your question, yes, you can certainly remind them, but I would encourage you to consider alternative ways of reminding them besides simply articulating the reminder in words. Thank you for the question. Okay, let's move on. Does anybody else have a question or an issue they'd like me to address? The question is another short, simple question, which I think I'll provide a short, simple answer. But the question is, do we really have to leave the house for date night? Can't we do it at home? The answer to the question is, if you insist, I guess so. In other words, the reason why one of the four rules for a successful date night is to get out of the house is because I believe that for 98% of the couples to really accomplish what I'd like to see you accomplish on date night, I think you've got to get out of the house. I can tell you in my life, in my marriage, we always get out of the house and we wouldn't be able to do it if we had to stay home. Last night was a bit of an exception. We went out for a couple of hours, and then we came back and rented a movie and watched it here in addition to the couple of hours. But we actually discussed the possibility of just staying home altogether, watching the movie. And you know what I said? I said to my wife, I said, you know, no, I don't think that's a good idea. Let's get out of the house. Let's spend a few hours together, and then we'll come back and watch the movie. She agreed. That's what we did. But it is possible. I mean, the reason why I'm suggesting that you get out of the house is because I think that a couple's got to get out of the house in order to get to that space, in order to really be with each other, in order to really connect, in order to get away from so many of the logistical and administrative concerns, issues, etc., that are just all around you when you're in the house. But it's possible, if for some compelling reason you need to try it, and if you are very disciplined, it is possible to get there, meaning that mental connected state, home. I mean, you could turn off the television, you could disconnect the telephones, you could close down the computers, you could make sure the kids are out of the house or asleep, or maybe even get a babysitter even though you're home, and make it a special night, a special dinner, or a special this, or a special that. It is possible to do it. And the requirement, or the rule of getting out of the house, is just something that I think will help you achieve the objective. But if you want to experiment and try to achieve it without getting out of the house, you might find that you can do it. But if there's not a compelling reason for you to try, well, then don't try. Just get out of the house. Dear Mort, shouldn't the TV be removed from the bedroom? TV is like a movie, which you told us to avoid on our dates. Yesterday, you told me to move back into the bedroom. This is a couple where he moved down to the basement, and I recommended that he move back into the bedroom. I attempted, but my wife was watching TV after our session Monday night. I needed to go to bed, and she also said that she had a cold. If the TV is removed, I think there's a typo here, there is more time to talk. So basically, this gentleman's question is, you advise me to move back into the bedroom. I'm willing to do that, which I commend you for, you know, being open-minded to my recommendation. But when I tried to do it, my wife was there watching TV. She didn't pay any attention to me, and I needed and had to go to sleep. Well, shouldn't we remove the television from the bedroom to begin with? So I'm going to answer the question on a couple of different levels. Look, if it were me, but you have to realize you're not married to me. But if you were married to me, sure, I agree with you. There's no question in my mind that if somebody like you, who doesn't want the television in their bedroom, comes to me and says, Mort, shouldn't we get rid of the television? Wouldn't that be a good thing for our relationship? I don't even hesitate. I wouldn't even hesitate to say, absolutely, the television is a relationship crusher. If you're watching television and facing it, then you are not facing each other. And couples too often pretend that they're spending time together by watching television when really there's nothing together about that time. Unless, okay, sometimes people are snuggling on the couch or, you know, one person gets the other popcorn. I mean, there is a way occasionally to make it a bonding experience. But for the most part, this kind of hour after hour mindless television, purely for the sake of being entertained, is not only a waste of life, but it is also very unproductive for your relationship. And so, objectively, if you were to ask me, you know, should we remove it, I would say absolutely. However, there's a huge variable here that I want to include in my response, which is, you're not married to me. You're married to your wife. And the question is, how does your wife feel about this? Let's say your wife were to disagree with me, and she wants the television in the bedroom. Well, that would completely change my response to you. Because although I would try to encourage her to think about the impact that this television might be having on her relationship and her life, and, you know, maybe she should consider a different television policy, maybe she should consider removing it from her bedroom, I would be happy to have that conversation with her. In fact, in week 6 of the Marriage Fitness Telebootcamp during the teleseminar, I might even get into it if I have time. It relates to a bigger issue, a bigger question, which we will be discussing extensively. However, if after my attempt to mentor her, your wife, to educate her about how, you know, what I think is right, if she disagreed or if she didn't want to do it, that's something very significant that you need to take into consideration. And so it's not just as simple as, you know, hey, I think we should get rid of this television. You know, shouldn't she do that if I'm going to move back into the bedroom? Objectively, yes, but maybe she doesn't feel that way, and you're going to have to figure out a way to navigate this with her so that she's not only sensitive to your need to, let's say, go to sleep or spend time with her, but also her need for mindless entertainment or whatever it is she's doing with the television. So I'd like to think that it was simple. I mean, I really would like to think that mature adults are intelligent enough to realize that watching television is just not a healthy and productive thing, as I said, for life in general, you know, no less for a relationship. And it can be very simple if two people agree that that's the case. I mean, you know, I'll just speak from a personal perspective. We don't even have a television in our house. I don't have any open sewage pipes in my house. Did you get that? I don't have any open sewage pipes in my house, which is basically what a television is, except for a few, except for a few exceptions. Not only don't I want it to interfere with my marriage, but I certainly don't want it to shape the mind and the character of my children. But that's another story. So I, you know, if two people agree, so then it is very simple. But I'm not naive enough to think that everybody agrees with the gentleman who wrote me this email or with me. And if you're married to somebody who doesn't agree, it certainly doesn't mean that you should run from the marriage. It doesn't mean your spouse is a bad person. It doesn't mean they're clueless. It just means that they feel differently about this issue now in their life. And that is a major factor that needs to be taken into consideration.
Hey, Mort?
Yeah.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Tonight's topic is fantastic as far as the trust right now. I've been going through my wife had a quote-unquote semi-affair, and I tried to...
A semi-affair? I never heard that one before. What is semi?
Well, I don't know all the details yet, so when, like, as far... I do know that she was involved with another man.
I see.
I don't know to what extent that
okay.
She took it. So I'm trying to obviously take all the information I'm gaining from you and wanting to trust her. But like even tonight, right now, she was due home at 8 o'clock. I'm on the same time as you are, you know, Eastern Standard or Eastern Daylight, whatever it is.
Right.
And she's still not home.
Uh-huh.
But so I'm thinking, okay, I'm chomping at the bit here. I want to question her about it, and I'm listening to your advice, and I'm thinking, okay, let me just let it go, believe in her, and it'll help me out. So what I am, what I want to know is, do I not say anything at all, just like when she comes in, welcome her? Because in other words, she is not happy in the marriage. I mean, she is out looking for, she wants more. We've been married 12 years. She wants more. And I'm like, well, tell me what more is. You've got everything right here.
let me answer a question you didn't ask. Who decided that she would be home at 8?
She told me she would be home at 8.
Next time she says she's going to be home at 8, say, you know what, honey, don't worry about it. Just come home whenever you come home. And the reason I recommended you do that is because she's, for whatever reason, is not able to come through yet. So help her set it up as a situation where she doesn't further break the trust. In other words, you have to know her better than she knows herself. For whatever reason, it's sad, but for whatever reason, she's not able to do the simple thing like say she'll be home at 8 and be home at 8, right? Talk about lack of integrity, right? And that's sad, but the fact of the matter is you need to know her better than she knows herself. So don't allow her to set herself up for failure.
Oh, I gotcha.
Nope. You know, in other words, don't allow her to make a commitment between the two of you that you know she's not going to keep. Now, on the other hand, know what she can achieve. If you know, I'm just making up the details, I don't know anything about you guys, but if you know that she stops at 7-Eleven each day home from work, and she's got a good memory, so ask her to pick up some milk before she comes home, because you know she'll succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And that will give both of you the sense of some success. Some, you know, you asked her to do something, she agreed to do it, and she did it. Remember, make and keep promises. Make and keep, make and keep. And now you're on the end where she's got to make and keep, but you've got to help her. You've got to set her up for promises that she can keep.
Okay. And I guess this is, like, in other words, I mean, I've always lived by your advice for the past year and making myself a better person. Being more understanding of her. In other words, when she told me last January, hey, I love you, but I'm not in love with you, I said, you know what? I got to find out why this happened to me.
Well,
so I read your workbooks and your emails and your website and everything. I said, this guy is the one that's going to do it for me. What is it going to take, though, for her to come around and realize how important the marriage is? In other words, if I know it's the most important thing in my life, you know, with my marriage is at the top, and then the kids, and then, you know, going down the list from there, when will she come around?
I can't answer that. I never met her. I can tell you this. You can't answer that question either. You don't know what's going to bring her around. But your job is to be ready. Any day. It could happen any day. You never know what's going to wake somebody up. I've seen situations where a friend gets into a car accident and they all of a sudden are in touch with the profundity of life. Sometimes it's the death of a mother or a father or a brother or a sister. Sometimes it's the birth of a child. God forbid, the death of a child. Maybe it's a friend or a family member who achieves a certain success in their life. I mean, the primary successes, they're with somebody and they really feel the closeness that they have with their child. And they start to really think, will I have that closeness? What's happening in my family? I mean, I'm just throwing out possibilities. I don't know what will wake her up. But everybody gets a wake-up call. Everybody, at some point in their life, gets a wake-up call. And your job is to be ready for it. So that when she gets that wake-up call, all of a sudden, she turns around and starts to look to you and to the marriage, and you look appealing, you look attractive, you look exciting, you look like a tower of moral authority that she can lean on and that she can be with.
Very good. I love what I'm going through so far. This is the second week, and believe me, it has really, really enlightened me, so I can't thank you enough.
Oh, well, you're very welcome.
I'm looking forward to the rest of it.
Good, good. Thank you. I'm going to go back to one email question here. Rather than reading the whole email, I'm just going to translate it into a couple of words, which I think will be relevant for many people on the line. The question is essentially about apologizing. And my guess is that every single person on the line right now and listening to this audio file or CD has made mistakes. We all make mistakes. And if you make a mistake, you owe an apology. And an effective apology can really be a tense healing part of the reconciliation process. The problem is, most people fail to apologize effectively. Most people don't really know how to apologize. And so I want to talk a little bit about how to apologize, because this is something that all of you can do. So let me start out by saying that apologizing has absolutely nothing to do with saying I'm sorry. Nothing. Most people think, I've apologized 100 times, I don't know what else to do. I'm going to tell you what else to do. because the reason you're feeling frustrated, like they haven't really forgiven you, is because you haven't really apologized in the right way. Once again, it has nothing to do with saying I'm sorry. You see, most people get to I'm sorry much too soon. Why? Because people very often are apologizing for themselves. In other words, it's really a selfish act very often. They're apologizing because they screwed up. They feel bad about it. They want things to be back to normal, or they want to be, you know, don't want to be punished anymore. So they come to their spouse, and in 2 seconds they say, I did X, Y, Z. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? Can we move on now? And so you caused some pain, some hurt, some suffering, and you want it all to be wiped away because you said, I'm sorry, in less than 60 seconds. And then you want to know why things aren't really back to normal and why you haven't really been forgiven or why they haven't moved through their hurt. So you have to realize that if you're the offender, that an apology is not for you. It's for them. They were the one that was offended. And your whole paradigm, your intention, can't be about you getting back to peace, about you getting relief from your guilt, from your anxiety, from your fear of losing your family, or whatever it is that you want out of the apology. It's got to be about your spouse. They were the one that was offended. Now, the other reason why people get to I'm sorry too quickly is because they're apologizing for what they did. You don't have to apologize for what you did. You have to apologize for the pain that you caused. That was the real damage. The suffering of your spouse. The experience that they had when you did whatever you did. This is really important, and I'll just give you two interesting examples to illustrate how important it is to realize what you're really apologizing for. Let's say that there was a woman who married to a man who believed in polygamy. In other words, she said to her husband, look, you can go sleep with whoever you want, I don't really care. So he goes and he has, quote, an affair. I put it in quotes because, you know, it's really not an affair. She permitted it. It's okay. Now, it's not okay. I mean, he made a mistake. He did something wrong. He may owe an apology to himself. He may have to apologize to his God. But does he owe an apology to her? I would say no. Well, what do you mean, Mort? He had an affair. Yeah, but an apology to her, she'd be laughing at him. You don't have to apologize to me. I don't care. In other words, there was no pain. There was no suffering. There's no problem. So there's an example where somebody could have done something so wrong and yet not even owe an apology to the person that they wronged because there was no pain. There was no suffering. There was no problem. I'll give you another example. A lot of times people will say, I'm not apologizing. I didn't do anything wrong. And see, once again, the person that's saying that is so focused on what they did and not on the impact that what they did had on their spouse that they feel they don't owe their spouse an apology. Could be. Sometimes people do the right thing and don't do anything wrong, but somehow my behavior, my actions, something I did, something I said, even though there was nothing technically wrong with it, somehow it was offensive or hurtful to my spouse. And you're darn right, if that's the case, you owe your spouse an apology, not because you did the wrong thing, but because you did something that created pain and suffering in them, and it's your responsibility to help them heal through that. And so if you're apologizing for the pain and suffering that you caused, so then how do you really know what that is? How do you know what their pain and suffering was? How do you know what to apologize for? The secret is to think. You've got to really spend time trying to get into the mind of your spouse. So much so that you can think their thoughts. Climb into their heart and feel their pain. When you get to the point in your thinking when you can cry their tear, now you're ready to apologize. And if you can articulate to them that pain in their heart, those thoughts in their mind, not your justification for what you did, this isn't about you, they're the one that's hurting. When you can articulate and explain the tear in their eye and make it yours, now your spouse is going to feel really understood. We're going to talk more about this next week, but that's one of the most important basic human needs, is the need to be understood. And the reason why people don't accept your apology is because they don't feel that you really understand them. They feel that you understand and acknowledge what you did, and you can explain why you did it. But that's not apologizing. They don't care about you. They're the one that's hurt. They're the one that's in pain. They're the one that's suffering. They're the one that wants to be understood. And when you apologize to them in a language that they feel understood, now they'll forgive you. And they really will be able to move through it and heal from it. Part of the reason why they'll be able to do that is because they'll feel safe that you won't do it again. Why? Because you would never make someone a victim to a crime that you've been a victim of. Why is that? Because if you've been a victim of a certain crime, so you know that pain. You could never deliver to somebody else that same pain. You're sensitive to it. That's why people make the same mistake over and over again. Because although they said they were sorry, they really don't understand the impact that it had on the other person. They understand what they did, and they understand why they did it. And so they use that same justification to do it all over again. And so a person doesn't really feel safe unless they feel like you really understand it from their perspective. If you can articulate their pain, they'll begin to feel safe with you again. Because they could see that you would never want to bring that tear to their eyes nor yours. And so I encourage, this is kind of like a bonus homework assignment that you can do anytime over the next 7 weeks. And you know what? You may have more than one to do. Most of you have screwed up in different ways. It could be more than one apology. And so over the next 7 weeks, I encourage you to do this, to really do the hard work. And it's thinking. It's sitting in a room privately, putting on some soft music, turning down the lights, lighting a candle, and just thinking and getting yourself inside your spouse's skin. What did they experience? What were they thinking? How did that relate to the relationship they had with their first spouse? How did that push a button because of the relationship they had with their mom when they were a child? How did the way I offended them relate to the experience they had in college when their friend did this, this, or this? In other words, really get inside their life, because that's what the problem is. That's where the hurt resides. And by the way, I recommend that you do this in writing as well as a face-to-face for a couple of reasons. First of all, when you write out an apology, it really forces you to clarify your thoughts, get in touch with their feelings, and to articulate yourself clearly. Secondly, if you do it right, almost inevitably, these kinds of conversations are very emotionally charged. There's very often, I mean, it can be a real breakthrough. It can be a real breakthrough. Tears and sobbing and yes, you finally get it, and you know it can really be something else. And you know, when you're in that kind of emotional experience, there's only so much that people can really get, really remember. So if you write it out and you have something to leave them with that they can read later, they won't miss anything. And again, that's, I'm not asking you to do that so they'll be impressed with you. I'm asking you to do that so that for them, because the better they understand how well you've come to understand them, the more easily they'll be able to heal through their hurt.
Maura, this is Dan.
Hello, Dan.
What if you're the person, you know, your spouse cheated on you, and, you know, I'm here in the Lone Ranger program, and, you know, it'd be nice if she apologized to me and wanted to work on things, and I'm being patient and trying to improve myself, but in some ways I kind of feel like, you know, I'm being the chump, like I'm the one that was victimized and now I'm the one that's trying to fix it. And, you know, how do you have any advice?
Let's take an apology, for example. I mean, let's say you said you were the victimized one. Does that mean she had an affair?
Yeah.
Okay. So she had an affair. Now, that obviously is a pretty dramatic and significant mistake that she has made. Okay. Now, did you also have an affair?
No.
No. Okay. Now, have you, though, made some mistakes in the marriage?
Sure.
Okay. So imagine, just imagine if you were her and you come to her with a really deeply thought out, heartfelt apology for the relatively minor mistakes that you've made in the marriage. I can't think of anything that you could do that would be a greater influence on her to consider doing the same for you. In other words, imagine you're in a marriage, your spouse cheated on you, and you come to her apologizing for your mistakes. I mean, she would have to begin to seriously consider whether or not she owes you an apology. How she effectively apologized? Is she helping you move through her hurt? Now, that doesn't mean that she's going to do it right away. I can't promise you that. But there's just no way that a human being could be on the receiving end of an apology about something relatively minor compared to infidelity and not begin to question their own behavior. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the other thing I'm confounded is, she said, well, you're just so needy and you suffocate me, and so me going and apologizing, it's like sometimes it feels like it makes it worse. Like, oh, look, I'm just clawing and groveling for anything, and I'm being a wimp, you know?
You know what I think? I totally hear what you're saying, but I think you need to rise above that. You need to have the confidence to know that it's a great person that's able to apologize. It's the contrary. It takes a big person to be able to really assess themselves and to admit when they've made a mistake. That's not a wimp. And I understand that may not be where your wife's mind is at right now, but sometimes you just have to have the confidence to know when you're right. And, you know, look, maybe there's something about the posture in which you do that. In other words, I'm not necessarily saying that you should get on your hands and knees and start crying and begging for forgiveness when you apologize. There's a way to apologize with dignity, with confidence, that the fact that I made this mistake doesn't make me a bad person. I'm a good person who made a mistake. And I'm even a better person for owning up to it. I hear what you're saying, but I just don't want you to be driven, your actions to be driven by her weaknesses, even if in the short term you think they may help your situation with her. In the long run, it won't help. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's a little bit analogous to, you know, a gentleman a couple boot camps ago got on the line and said to me, you know, Mort, I downloaded one of these ebooks from one of your colleagues. And I said, oh, really? What kind of, you know, like how to stop your divorce ebook. So I don't know. You can probably gather I'm not like a big fan of these, you know, quick fix ebooks. In the ebook, this guy recommended that in order to get my wife back, I should start dating other women. Okay, dating other women. Why? Because this gentleman, this author explained that if I start dating other women, I'll make my wife jealous and she'll want me to come back. Now, I hear what he's saying. I think that's horrible advice. I don't recommend it to anybody. And let me explain why. Is it true that the human psychology, that could be effective human psychology? Could you get a woman, just for example, to come back to her husband because she's jealous of other women? Yeah. But that might be the short-term effect. But what's the long-term effect? The long-term effect is you've just confirmed for her that you're the very person that she wanted to leave to begin with. I mean, think about what you just did. You're dating other women to get your wife to come back to you? That's manipulative. That wouldn't be the kind of man that she would want to be with. And by the way, What about the women you dated? Right? I mean, they're looking for love. They want to get married. They thought you were divorced or separated or something. It's not nice. That's not the person that you want to be. The only way to really fix your marriage in a lasting way is to transform yourself, is to become a new husband. And that's not becoming a new husband. That's manipulative. That's not nice. That's the whole reason why she left. And although you may succeed to manipulate her to come back in the short term, in the long run, unless you really make the changes, she'll be face to face with the same man and she'll end up leaving again, except this time she's gone for good. Because you only get one chance at a second chance. And so I don't recommend you blow it by, you know, dating other women, just as an example. And why did I bring that up? I know that's not exactly your question, but because I bring it up because I think that that question was also motivated by the weakness in another person, in their spouse. And I think that your hesitation to own up to your mistakes and to apologize is being motivated by the weakness in your wife, even if in the short term it would be effective. And I think you want to be driven by loftier ideals.
My question is that I think, for the past 3 months, even before I get on with the camp, I read your book, and I've tried from the positive perspective to be a better wife and to listen to his concerns. So I've tried things like not to argue, always listen, and then maybe come around to issues later. And I tried to cook the food that he really likes, and so because I know what he likes to eat. Even though he liked all that, and he told me that, you know, I've seen dramatic changes in you. However, his idea about his missing out possibilities of all the other women and potential happiness, better happiness per se, it's really something more like a project, a mission at this point.
More like a what? More like a what?
Project. A project needs to be accomplished, or a mission needs to be accomplished.
Uh-huh.
This is because I can see that sometimes he has to try hard not to laugh, to say, try to be mean. So that he can let me know clearly, you know, you're not anywhere near me because I already said so. I want to get away from you. I don't want to have anything to do with you because, you know, I already made my conclusion. So evidently I tried certain things. I think I haven't been able to make that deep level connection which we had when we met initially. That's what got us together.
It sounds to me like your efforts have created more of a connection between your husband, or at least are pulling him towards that connection. And that's exactly why he feels compelled to pull back and to make those statements that this is nice, but... Do you know what I'm saying? In other words, he wouldn't feel the need to make those statements, to clarify for you his need to date other women, and to clarify for you the certainty of his decision,
right,
if he didn't feel some tug in the other direction.
Okay, so but it seems like it's kind of pushing me away, and he goes, you know, a while after you made such a huge change, if I still cannot feel the passion that I initially had with you, then that's just to tell me that, you know, this is not going to work. So I bet I got to run. That's why he's running. It's like devotion is not a good thing to him. If you're devoted, then you're pushing me to, like, I have to run. I need my space. So I don't know between the space, the balance of giving him the space, and also I need a certain boundary because we,
I think then when I try to establish boundary, I'm afraid that that's going to generate any negative feelings on his side. Per se, then he would think, oh, you're being firm and strong, I'll push again, which is one of the things that he thought I was, or at least he told his friends, he probably told me too, a couple of times, that he thought, you know, you're the one making the decision, always feels like you're right. So I try to back off from that, which I am really sincerely are trying not to put up on the show, because I realize if I cause him to feel that way, you know, regardless of what I did, I need to modify the way communication or the way I send out a message. So I really try that. Now I'm struggling with how do I get the balance between the boundary. Really, there need to be a boundary even for myself, because just because I'm trying to improve the situation, the relationship, doesn't mean I can let him to step on me in whatever way he wants to. He can get away from whatever behavior he can want to. He can, you know, he feel likes to have. But at the same time, the language, the approach, what should I say not to let him feel like, you know, I'm going back to be a little bit aggressive with him. I just don't know if that would be too strong of action, because I really think that we're in such a delicate situation. Any incorrect, inappropriate move could cause further damage to the relationship, which is something I don't want to see. I want to see, I want to build, I don't want to tear apart.
Right. I think, Helen, you'd be much better served in this case, rather than give so much thought to how you think he'll react to you.
Uh-huh.
I think you'd be much better served to just think more about what should you do? What would be the right thing to do? What would be the sensitive thing to do? What would be the thing that a great person of towering moral authority would do?
Uh-huh.
And do it. Do the right thing.
Okay.
I
got it. I think that's a great advice. I should not let the situation, get me away from doing the right thing.
Right.
And if in the end I did all I can, I think...
Exactly. You started out your question by saying, you know, you've been doing certain things, and I pointed out to you that I think those things that you're doing are tugging him and the relationship in the right direction, even though he maybe isn't willing to go there yet. And I just want to point out something to you that I think will be very instructional for everybody. It's very important, so everybody please listen carefully. It's important for you, everybody, all of us, to really respect the process that everybody goes through in their life. In other words, take for example, let me get back to the story of the guy who called me today, Mort, I need to speak to you immediately. And I looked up and it was 70 days ago that he typed in, I don't know, whatever, marriage help into Google, found Mort Fertel and subscribed to my email list 70 days ago. Where's he been for 70 days while his marriage is falling apart? But you know what? Everybody's timing is different. And 2 days ago, he probably couldn't have heard a word I said. Today, I would bet you that after our hour session, he had 3 pages of notes. And he ran from the phone on our session to the office of his wife to talk to her about some of the things we had discussed. Why? Why? Where was he 70 days ago? Where was he yesterday? But it's about timing. We all go through a certain emotional evolutionary process, spiritual evolutionary process. We all go through a certain maturity process in our life. And if you just think about your own life, think about times when you've been open to hearing certain things, speaking to certain people, doing certain things, making certain changes. Whenever it was that you were open to it, you were only open to it at that time. And you wouldn't have been ready any other time. And it's important to realize that just because you're ready now doesn't mean that your spouse is on the same path. And so this kind of gets back to some of the discussion I was mentioning earlier about the importance of committing to things, you know, like loyalty and commitment and things that really, I think, bring lasting happiness, because those things will also lead you to have a certain respect for your spouse's process, which is going to be different than yours. It simply is. No two people's process is exactly the same. And which means that, I mean, I hope it's not the case, Helen, but maybe your husband has to, I mean, it pains me to say it, but maybe your husband has to date other women. Maybe that's just what he has to go through in his life at this time before he gets to the point to realize that he's behaving like a child, he's got a family, he's got a wife, and, you know, and there's more to life than the momentary pleasures that he's desiring at this moment. I don't know him. I never met him. I didn't speak to him, you know. But maybe...
You will.
I will on Friday, right? I know. But, you know, maybe this is the process that he has to go through. And just as you would want somebody to respect your process and not push you, not rush you, so too you need to respect his process and give him the time and the space to go through. You know, as I think I mentioned last week, you can't make a seed grow. You could kill it, but you can't make it grow.
Right.
What you can do, though, is you can create an environment where it's most likely to grow. You can give it water, fertilizer, make sure it gets the proper sunlight. But ultimately, the seed's going to grow in its time and its way when it decides. And that's the way people are. You know, it's like I do a lot of public speaking. And I have mixed feelings about it, because sometimes I'm invited, very often I'm invited to groups. They're not groups like you. You know, in other words, you all have marital issues. You know, you went online, you sought me out. You're listening. You're listening to me. You want to know how I can help you. You need help. And that's one type of audience. But a lot of times I go to speak, and for whatever reason, you know, the organizer of this organization heard that I was a good speaker, that, you know, I have an interesting message about marriage, and they decided to bring me in to speak to their group of 100 people. Now, I think I am a good speaker. I have a good message. You know, I have a sense of humor. I'm clear. But when I speak to groups like that, I can see half the people nodding off. Now, why are they nodding off? Am I a bad speaker? Is my message boring? No, I don't think that's it. You know what it is? It's that they're not ready. You can't give someone an answer to a question they don't have. So I come prepared to give an answer, but they don't have the question. So there's nothing I could do to capture their hearts, to get their attention. They're just not ready. It's the wrong time in their life. Doesn't mean, by the way, that they don't have a bad marriage. It just means they're not ready to really listen, to really hear it. And in fact, very often I can see in their, it's very interesting, I can see in their body language those that do have bad marriages, and they're like fighting my message, because I'm pretty good about getting through to people. I know how to keep those people awake. I know how to sort of tickle their soul and get them to think about things they haven't thought about in 40 years. And you can see people kind of fighting me. They're like struggling to ignore me because it's too uncomfortable for them to think about the things that I'm getting them to think about that they don't really want to think about. And by the way, just parenthetically, I believe that's the job of an educator sometimes. The job of an educator sometimes is not to provide answers, but it's to be a midwife and to bring about the birth of the question. Because if you can't help a student give birth to the question, then it doesn't matter how great an answer you have, it's fruitless. And with all of you, you all have a question, so this program is geared towards providing you with an answer. But depending on the audience I'm speaking to, I don't see my role as the role as providing an answer. I see my role as trying to be a midwife and bring about the birth of the question. And the reason I bring that up is because that is the role for some of you in the context of your marriage, is not to tell him what to do and to give him the answer, but to realize where he's at in his life. He doesn't yet have the question. And you've got to be like a midwife and try to bring about the birth of that question.